Welcome back to the Stratcom podcast. I'm pleased to be joined today by Graham Brookey. Graham is the Senior Director of the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab based in Washington, D.C. The DFR lab is at the forefront of open source research with a focus on governance, technology, security, social media, and where each of those intersect. So perhaps we could begin by discussing your work with DFR lab on identifying and uncovering, countering hostile disinformation. And perhaps it would be useful to start at the most basic level, so to say. Could you tell me how open source investigations inform policy and maybe share some examples of the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks so much for having me. And it's great to be back in Riga. We were just talking about this before we began. We have teams here. We have researchers here. And so it's really nice to be back and working with partners. For the DFR lab, we look at basically how the online information ecosystem impacts our real world. And so for us, we do essentially three things. We do research and reporting. And as you said, it's open source research and reporting. Mm-hmm. We look at things online that are available to everybody, right? You could pull it up on your phone. And we piece it together like a puzzle to say, here's what we know about whatever the thing is, whether that's a case of disinformation, whether that's a different online harm, whether that's evidence of even war crimes, right? In a conflict zone where you wouldn't assume that the internet is as available. And so we do a lot of research like that, data-driven research to prove things are happening. And that takes a lot of work. The second thing that we do is a lot of capacity building. Right, we want to see, because this is a new field, we want to see more people do the work that our research teams do, the open source research teams do. And we want to raise the standards for that. Because it's really easy to look at the internet and say, oh, well, I know everything about this topic. The standards building is to make sure that across this space, as more and more people get into open source research, you know, there are rules, there are standards, there's a quality that you have to kind of abide by. And frankly, for capacity building, it's a matter of getting more people to do this kind of work so that, you know, the researcher that's looking at online harms in Brazil knows that the researcher that's looking at disinformation in Latvia, they share the same values and the same mission. They know that they have each other's back. And so that's a big part of it for us. And hopefully, if we're doing the first two things right, especially the data-driven research, then we build a record on any given thing that we're looking at to inform policymakers in a way that is evidence-based and undeniable, to say, here's what we see with regard to this online harm or disinformation trends, disinformation defined as the spread of false information intentionally, right? Somebody means to do that. And so giving that body of evidence to the public, for one, first and foremost, media, for sure, to kind of help explain kind of what's going on, as well as partners in government to go do something about it. That's the basis for us. And at this point, the DFR lab has a global team, right? We have, of course, researchers and staff based at the Atlantic Council headquarters in Washington, D.C. We have a team in Brussels, of course. But we have teams all around the world, Latin America, Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Africa, based in South Africa, covering the continent, team that's focused on East Asia. They're based in the United States, but so their time zones are a little tough when they're looking at the online information environment. And then, of course, teams across Europe, including in the Far East, like Tbilisi, Georgia, including Poland, and still in Ukraine to this day, mm-hmm. as well as right here in Riga.
Thank you for this. That does sound like immensely valuable research, but I think a natural follow-up would be to ask, are policymakers receptive to your findings? There, of course, have been several notable instances in Europe and in the United States of parliamentary bodies commissioning investigations, launching investigations into issues like disinformation or foreign interference. But then when it comes to actual implementation, it seems that they've been far less enthusiastic. So could you tell me more about this gap?
Well, I think, you know, there's good news and bad news, right? The good news is that, again, this is a really new field. And so the questions that we're getting, I think there's two two or three policy areas in particular that we work in. And the questions across those policy areas over the last 5 years have gotten a lot better. I'll pick on the United States for just 1 minute. There's a very famous moment where Mark Zuckerberg is sitting in front of the United States Senate and they get to ask him any questions. Yeah. And in what, 2017, 2018, the questions were not that informed, yeah. Right? How do you make money on Facebook? And he kind of looks incredulously and says, well, we sell ads, Senator, as if it was the most obvious thing in the world. And so for us, building that body of evidence and frankly, a higher understanding of how the internet impacts our day-to-day lives and frankly, how we as people every single day connect with each other online as well as consume information online. And so having that broader base of understanding informs a couple of things. One, the policy issues on explicit harms, right? The worst things that possibly happen on the internet and how can we build more resilience or address those harms, mm-hmm. Ranging from criminal activity to election, like lying to people at scale, to really, really egregious, like violent content that you don't want everybody to be able to see or have it go viral. So that's number one, is online harms, like the worst stuff that happens on the internet. The second is overall tech policy, right? What happens with all of these platforms that underpin and create our information environment? And so the way that search engines like Google or frankly even YouTube, which people don't remember is a search engine, how do those work? How do social platforms that are basically news driven like Twitter work? How does Facebook, which does a little bit of everything, ranging from where you go to buy secondhand furniture for your house or where you go to see what your friends from, you know, high school are doing, right? How do all of those work individually? What are they designed to do, which they all do something slightly different? And then how do they all interconnect? And what's that impact on things like elections or things like democracy, the shared set of facts that democracy depends on? And then the third category, I think, is, what the Atlantic Council is designed to do, foreign policy and national security policy. And right now, I mean, current events, obviously, there is a truly global competition for information. And so how do we position the geopolitics around, how do we inform the geopolitics around that to make sure that it bends towards more transparency, more accountability, and a shared set of facts in this hyper-connected and now very global information environment?
So today, of course, everyone's hearts and minds are focused on the tragic events in Ukraine. Could you tell me about some discoveries that DFR Lab has made in this regard? Maybe what are some worrying trends in the information space that you're seeing?
Yeah, so right now, what our teams are doing around the clock is looking at the online information environment focused on Ukraine. And that's not just the Ukrainian information environment. It is, what is the information environment in Russia about this conflict? What is the information environment around the region and across Europe about this, about Russia's invasion of Ukraine? And then what does it look like globally? And so we're looking at all of those things. The teams that we have right now in Georgia, Ukraine, Poland, of course, here in Latvia, in the United States and Brussels are all looking at this together. And so we've taken a lot of our researchers and they're looking at this around the clock. Now, this isn't the first time that they're looking at Ukraine, right? We've been monitoring things like hostile narratives against the targeting the enhanced forward presence here in the Baltics and Poland for the last 5 years, every single week for the last 5 years. We've been monitoring violations of the Minsk agreements every week for the last 5 years using open sources again. And so this is kind of a consolidation of work that we've been doing for a long time. Now, with regard to the current military offensive that Russia's perpetrating, there's a couple of things that we're very, very focused on. One is using the online information environment to verify what is happening militarily, right? What is the online evidence of the worst things that happen in war? And how do we build an archive that is publicly available and transparent and creates accountability for Russia's actions against Ukraine? And so there, you know, using social media posts about the targeting of schools, civilian infrastructure, hospitals, proving that that actually happened, or the evidence, the growing body of evidence that there are banned munitions being used, like cluster munitions. Of course, from Russia, this isn't new. This is things that we've seen in the online information environment in previous hostile military activity from Syria, Ukraine, of course, before. And so it's a matter of building that public record because they will deny what they are doing, right? And that's the ballgame right now. Now, in addition to that, that's the verification of what is happening on the ground. The second component of that is looking at how Russia is navigating or trying to manipulate the online information environment. So as we've seen the military build up over 3 months' time, what we also saw, we were verifying that there was a lot of military equipment coming in from the far east of Russia, number one. Number two, at the same time, in the online information environment, we saw a massive surge in influence operations. And influence operations online that sometimes include disinformation, right? But those are two slightly different things that can kind of be together at sometimes. And what we saw was this massive surge of disinformation coming from Russia to justify an attack. Of course, a lot of those every single one of those narratives was false. And now as the offensive military operation grows, we see, in addition to that disinformation justifying an attack, we see more narratives that are also denying and deflecting responsibility for what is happening on the ground. And that's, of course, a concern.
If I could perhaps ask a somewhat blunt or self-evident question, you mentioned the process of building a record of evidence documenting instances of Russian aggression. But what's the point? Why is that important? Do you think that this archive could be somehow used in international legal proceedings against Russia, or what purpose would this archive serve?
Well, first and foremost, this conflict is happening right before our eyes. And if we turn away, then the responsibility is ours, right? And so building a record, a public record, a verifiable record, an undeniable record, is extraordinarily important to document the history of what is happening right now. And adjust and hold those the Russian military for sure and the Russian government accountable for their actions. And so to your question about where that body of evidence goes, it's publicly available. It can be used by multilateral fora, right? There will be a large debate in places like the UN about what is happening. Of course, what is happening is undeniable, and so we would see that body of evidence be used there.
Ukraine also launched a case at the ICJ.
Right. International legal venues like the ICJ, potentially the ICC, right? We would see that body of evidence. This is the most publicly available body of evidence of what is happening. And it supplements the firsthand witness accounts, right? And so when there's a witness that says, I was in Kiev when it got bombed, I was in Kharkiv when it got bombed. Yeah. There's also a body of evidence to show exactly what happened. And that's the point. Mm-hmm. It's an accountability mechanism. And again, if we turn away from it, then it's our shame.
Thank you for this. I think one question that maybe is somewhat underreported or less known, especially among audiences in the West, is the question of what narratives are Russian people exposed to about this war? What do ordinary Russians know, even, about what is happening in Ukraine? Could you tell me about some key narratives or themes that Russian state television, radio, media are propagating?
Right. So this is the first point about what information normal Russian people, everyday Russian people, get about what is happening in Ukraine right now. Is a really good question, first and foremost. And second, it goes back to the heart of what it means to be living in an authoritarian country. Mm-hmm. The first priority of any authoritarian country is to retain power. And the mechanism in a hyper-connected world to retain power is to control information. And so we see a number of efforts. I'll start with the infrastructure efforts to control the information environment, and then the messaging efforts to control the information environment in Russia right now. First and foremost, the infrastructure efforts. We've seen a lot of requests from the Russian government to large social media platforms to censor content, to remove certain kinds of functionality on platforms. And that's a battle that is understood or underreported, but raging right now. And so you've seen a lot of back and forth between Russian government as well as the large tech platforms, in not only U.S. headquartered platforms, but European headquartered platforms and Russian headquartered platforms, in Russia government's demands of what they can and cannot be doing in Russia. Yesterday, my colleague from the DFR lab, Nika, who's based right here in Latvia, used the term digital iron curtain. What they're trying to do is create a digital iron curtain. I think that's an informative term. And so what the tech companies do in response is extraordinarily important. And then beyond what happens with the, like what is happening with the actual platforms with tech companies, it, of course you have to focus on how the Russian government is messaging to its own people. And there, it's riddled with disinformation, right? Vladimir Putin's speech before the invasion began was basically the greatest hits of...
a collection of historical grievances, right. Complaints, and so on.
The greatest hits of any number of disinformation narratives that we've seen for a long, long time, but all in one place at one time. And the audience for that, because we got a lot of questions about this. Who was the audience for that speech? Was it Western policymakers? Was it the international public? The answer is no. There were two audiences. One was the Russian people, right? Positioning for the Russian people to retain power. The second was to create a body of kind of quotes and a record, like a speech, that will be then used in international debates at, for instance, the UN Security Council going forward, right? It's the basis for their position in this conflict, and that the basis for their position in this conflict at its core is disinformation. And so for the Russian people, right, one of the interesting things messaging from the West is that, you know, as Western partner allies and partners stand up in support of Ukraine, that's not against the Russian people at all. Mm-hmm. It's against what the Russian government is doing to the Ukrainian people. And so that's a key point. And that message is really, really hard to get to the Russian people because that information environment is more and more closed. And Putin's main kind of goal is to retain control of that information environment. I think that there are some cracks there. And you're seeing some amount of, you're seeing more dissent against hostile military invasion of Ukraine among the Russian population. So we'll be curious to see how sustained and how vocal the protests in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg are, whether those grow. Of course, there will be a violent crackdown against them. But you're also seeing a number of very prominent public figures who haven't said much about anything before, anything that they would deem to be politics before, speak out against the war. And so there's clearly something happening in that information environment that for us, it's very difficult to measure so far because it is so closed and it is so retained.
But perhaps it would be useful to elaborate on how we can break through, if at all, break through this iron curtain, break through this iron grip on control of the information space. Again, you said that your institution, but also many other research bodies, are creating this public archive of evidence about what the Russian regime is doing. Is there any way to magically teleport this archive in a digestible way to an ordinary lady living in Yekaterinburg or Petersburg or any other Russian city?
This is a really difficult challenge. And the straightforward answer is we've got to try. Because we have to try to figure out how to make the entire information environment more transparent and more accountable. And for us, right, there isn't one policy that is going to achieve that. But where you see a crackdown on open platforms, where you see an attempt to censor more content or remove any mention of war in an entire country that is at war, that is truly Orwellian. That's not transparent and not accountable, to say it diplomatically, right? That's a problem. And so how do we work on all fronts, both the building a body of publicly available information or a record of war, as well as make sure that the overall information environment, including standards for media, international media, domestic media, whoever media, the social media platforms, how do we make sure that our information environments around the world bend towards transparency and are accountable to publics? Mm-hmm. And so there isn't, again, one policy that will... in the United States, we have a lot of policy about what should happen with social media platforms. Yep. Of course, in the EU, there are huge, huge debates about specific things on content moderation. And there isn't one policy that will bend the entire information environment towards accountability. Mm-hmm. We have to chip away at it and build resilience.
Thank you. Ukraine has also been a well-documented sort of... testing ground for various Russian hybrid warfare tools and instruments. So one high-profile example was, of course, the cyber attacks on Ukrainian banks and government institutions. And later, those same tools were used in the SolarWinds attack in the United States, which proved to be very costly. In terms of this conflict, the ongoing aggression, are you seeing any such experimentation with new tools? Are there any new hybrid instruments that the Russian regime is using?
The short answer is no. The slightly more complicated answer is that it's still, frankly, early. And of course, what we've seen in terms of the military operations, in my opinion, is a fairly significant miscalculation on the Russian government's part, on Vladimir Putin's part, mm-hmm. of how hard it would be to execute this operation. And so we haven't seen anything that is categorically new. We've kind of seen them probing on a number of fronts. Of course, at the very beginning or just before their offensive military operations kicked off in earnest, there was, and there remained, a couple of DDoS attacks in the cyber mm-hmm. realm or harassment of websites, state-facing websites or civic websites in Ukraine. Yep. And so we would expect to see more of that. But we haven't seen any pieces of equipment that stick out to us to say that's something we haven't seen before, mm-hmm. Frankly, we haven't seen any tactics. Now, again, we're only less than a week into offensive military activity, and so we wouldn't necessarily expect to see that right away, which is why it is so important to stick on this, right? To build that record over time, to say, at this point, here's what we saw that was new and interesting. It allows us to have a baseline understanding of what we've seen before and identify very quickly hybrid tactics that might be outliers or new or categorically different in some way.
But
frankly, so far we've seen aggressive deployment of information operations.
Yeah.
It's been surprising to see that we haven't seen as many tactics or the new tactics, covert tactics, as before. That would indicate that it's getting harder for them because there is such a bit large community of defenders or transparency activists that are looking at this, right? The eyes of the world are on this. The eyes of researchers, like at the DFR lab, are on this. And so it's a little bit harder, right? In 2014, 2015, for instance, there was a original report from the groups that would become DFR lab, and then a number of independent journalists, a number of the folks that would become Bellingcat, and it was called Hiding in Plain Sight. And the open source for that conflict, Russia trying to invade Ukraine again or influence Ukraine again, in 2014, 2015 was soldiers taking selfies in the conflict zone and then verifying exactly where they were and how that corroborated to attacks, which they corroborated very directly to attacks.
Do you think Russian military planning has learned from this? Do you think, do you see that in this ongoing aggression, command has disciplined soldiers to avoid making such mistakes, to stop posting their troop movement on TikTok?
They've certainly tried, but it's not as possible given how the internet works, right? If there's a large convoy of tanks coming through your backyard, then that's typically not something that happens every day. A lot of people will take out their phone and say, oh my gosh, look at what is happening in my backyard. Why are these tanks here, right? And that goes on the internet. So we have a team of researchers that will see that. For the Russian military, it's been interesting to see. They know that denying and deflecting outright, like they did in 2014, 2015, is not as possible at this point. And so that's why we saw the sustained focus on just using disinformation and influence operations that deploy disinformation to justify preemptively an attack. That way, when it happens, they don't have to deny that they have troops there. And so we've seen that positioning in public using disinformation, but we also haven't seen as many posts specifically or publicly posted information from the Russian military as they've moved into Ukraine. And that's somewhat interesting. We have seen a lot of social media content of Russian troop movements from other people, including normal Ukrainians. That's very interesting. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as the conflict goes on.
But on the topic of something new or new tactics or strategies that have been used, I think an important example to discuss would be the approach of Western governments and intelligence agencies in the months leading up to the invasion to pursue this strategy of pre-bunking, so sort of publicly exposing Russian military planning, different specific plots to fabricate a pretext for invading Ukraine. It clearly shows that the US, but UK and other NATO allies have, well, infiltrated, I guess, Russian military planning to a fairly high degree. But with hindsight, what lessons do you think can be taken from this strategy? Was it effective? Do you think governments will use that in the future? What is your assessment?
Well, I think it's a highly effective strategy. The strategy of, so to be clear, I don't have access to the intelligence that any of those governments, including my own government, has, right? And none of us do. That's the point. And so the strategy of rapid declassification of intelligence assessments, and that's all sources, I would assume, right? Governments have access to intelligence collection capabilities. And they also have access to the online information environment or the open information environment that we're all looking at every single day. And so that's what we call all source analysis, right? They take all of the sources of information, they make an assessment. And the strategy from especially allied and partner governments, including the US, the United Kingdom, member states of the EU and NATO partners, of course, of rapidly declassifying what they assess Russia to be planning has been extraordinarily effective because they've been engaging with publics on what they think is going to happen. And so what that does is it limits the time and space in which Russian disinformation about what they are going to do takes root. And so it limits the impact and the audience engagement of and builds resilience against Russian disinformation. So that way, when all of these justification narratives from Russia, the false justification narratives from Russia are coming together, the allies and partners have said, we know something about this. This is false. This is absolutely false. And that's really effective. We need to see that going forward. What that does is it bends more towards transparency and accountability. It limits the space in which disinformation can take root. And that's incredibly important. And one of the a couple of things about this strategy, I think, that are really important just for us to kind of reflect on as policymakers decide if this strategy is going to set precedents. One is a lot of this information is publicly available, right? There isn't a risk of
like exposing sources, for example.
Exposing source, exactly right. Because from the DFR lab, we saw a lot of this information in public sources, right? There was an enormous amount of military buildup that we were seeing on the internet, right on the border of Ukraine for 3 months' time, for 4 months' time. And so a lot of that information is not classified. But for governments to come out and say, this is what we see is happening, that's extraordinarily powerful. And it was not designed. There's been some feedback that says, oh, well, there was this declassification strategy, this engagement strategy, but Vladimir Putin decided to invade anyways. And the
deterrence failed somehow.
The purpose of that strategy is not necessarily to deter a military invasion, right? That has a lot of other factors that go into it. But what it does is it limits their space, again, to justify that military offensive, to justify hostile military operations against a democracy, against a government that is duly elected by its own citizens, a sovereign nation. The second component of that is it binds allies and partners together, right? It has limited the space in which allies, because there is that public record, can kind of disagree with each other because it's undeniable what is happening. And so it makes standing up together easier to do. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing that I think is really effective about that strategy is that it gives a way for governments to talk to their people. It gives us a way to hear from our government consistently about what is happening. And that is really, really useful because, again, going back to how regular people, how normal people, everyday people that aren't necessarily focused all the time on Ukraine are understanding this conflict, they're understanding because their government is standing up and saying exactly what they know about it. And that's really, really important.
It's a bond of trust.
Right.
I also wanted to ask whether you think there is an important psychological dimension, an underlying dimension of this strategy. Do you think that by revealing this information through this rapid declassification, that Western governments and intelligence agencies are signaling to the Kremlin, we know what you are up to, we have sources inside? And do you think that this makes the regime in the Kremlin in any way more paranoid? Do you think it will shape the regime's behavior in any way moving forward?
I am in no position, because I'm not a psychologist, to understand the level of paranoia within the Kremlin.
Surely,
or within
it would make you more paranoid, no? If you were making plans and then suddenly they kept constantly getting leaked publicly on right. Twitter, surely this would shape your behavior, right?
I think importantly, what it does is it creates friction to the decision making. Right, it certainly limited their options to say time and location of invasion, how those military operations shape up, right? Like which military options are available to them, and certainly, I would assume, created some kind of big question marks about whether this was the right idea or not, and you see that playing out in public. Again, going back to Russian support, especially from fairly senior policymakers, there were pretty clear indications that senior levels of advisors to Vladimir Putin were questioning what this strategy was, and that was disclosed publicly. So I think that's very effective. I think that it certainly creates obstacles, friction, and big question marks about whether this was a policy that Russia, whether this hostile military invasion of another country was the right thing to do, which of course it was not.
Well, I think those tasked with economic or monetary policy have a lot on their plate right now.
Right, right. Yeah.
So maybe to move on from the subject of Ukraine, I came across your work on election interference in the United States and on the problem of domestic extremism and political violence. Of course, more than a year now has passed since the January 6th Capitol insurrection, but obviously to this day, conspiracy theories about this event and about other topics continue to flood private messaging groups, social networks, even they can sometimes be seen on major news outlets, I would say. Could you tell me whether you think the situation has changed in any way, and have policymakers gathered the right conclusions from those tragic events?
So this is really a challenging topic in the United States, first and foremost. And for us, being an organization, a research organization that has a global staff, but is headquartered in the United States, it was a matter of transparency and credibility for us to look at ourselves, right? This is not something that's happening in a country like Russia, where there's a large research team that's looking at, you know, at the government, what the election cycle looks like. And so for 2020 elections in the United States, there were three really, really large efforts that we thought were important, and we thought would be mechanisms for accountability in our own country, which is wildly important to our credibility around the world. One was to monitor misinformation and disinformation about the election itself, right? And narrowly defined, because you can't monitor you can't find all of the disinformation, all of the misinformation about everything. That's very challenging, or possibly impossible. But we created a partnership with three other really, really good research organizations: the Stanford Internet Observatory, the Washington University Center for Informed Public, and Graphica, which is a big research team, as well as DFR Lab. And we created the Election Integrity Partnership, in which we had a very large team of people looking at mis and disinformation about the process of the election, where, when, and how to vote, as well as the results of the election, which, as the world now knows, was a major, it continues to this day, the big lie election-related about the results of the election is still an ongoing challenge in the United States. The second project that we had was understanding foreign influence, which has now become a very large topic of conversation in the United States. If you were to show up in the middle of the United States and talk to somebody who doesn't necessarily read the news every single day and say, do you know about foreign influence in elections? They would probably say, of course I know something about this. So it's this topic that kind of has gone into the mainstream discourse. And for us, it was really important to distinguish exactly what was credible and what was not, and so that the specter of foreign influence wasn't a lot bigger than the actual problem of foreign influence, or the threat of foreign influence. And so for us, we monitored, it was called the Foreign Interference Attribution Tracker. And we looked at every single unique allegation or claim of foreign influence during the election cycle, and we gave it a credibility rating based on our own research. We either verified it, or in cases that we weren't able to verify it, we looked at the source and kind of looked at whether that was likely or not, whether there was a history of it. And then importantly, we measured every single one of those attributions and how it was amplified in public. So what was the audience reach of that allegation? And what we found was something very interesting. The least credible attributions got the most amount of attention. And so that's a big challenge going forward in the information environment, especially as we're talking about things that get conflated or confused against each other quite often, which include disinformation, which the scale and scope of domestic disinformation in places like the United States and a number of democratic countries, frankly, is much higher than the scope of foreign influence that uses disinformation. Typically the latter preys on the other. And then to your question, we also monitored an increasing amount of political violence or domestic violent extremism that uses disinformation as an on-ramp to more radicalized activity. And so there, what we've saw is over the year leading up to the election, there was a lot of various groups on a pretty wide spectrum of ideology, right? You had militia groups in the United States that have typically been very, very anti-government. You have very, very, very small groups that are outright calling for the overthrow and have been for years. And then you have some kind of more ideology or more kind of radicalized violent groups or that engage in criminal activity, very famously groups like the Proud Boys. And then you have folks that are engaged in conspiracy theories, right, that believe in outright disinformation. So the adherence to things like the QAnon conspiracy. And so each one of those groups is slightly different, right? It's slightly more or less radicalized.
There's no one centralized infrastructure there.
Right. And what we saw around January, and then of course you have political enthusiasts who kind of come into this to witness something or believe in a political ideology. And that's very different than calling for the overthrow of the government, right? And so on, we had a very large monitoring activity or monitoring effort to look at especially radicalized violent extremism that affected the process of the election, where, when, and how to vote, as well as the results of the election. And after the election, of course, as the big lie was taking root, we saw online coordination, a lot of these groups kind of coalesce into one. And so the key thing about January 6th is that we saw it coming on the internet, right? All of these groups were
who is the we here? Is it DFR Lab or is it regular people or is it the FBI? Who is the we?
For sure, researchers at the DFR Lab, but a lot of the kind of folks in this community that look at online disinformation saw this coming because if someone says, I believe in X, verifiably false thing, and because of that, I'm going to go do Y activity. Mm-hmm. You don't have to take them at their word for the first thing, but generally you should take them fairly seriously for the second thing. If they say they're going to go do something. What we saw in the lead up to January 6th was a coalescing of those groups into one very large group. And that dates back well before the election, right? More radicalized activity or more conspiracy adherence based on things like COVID, or the reaction to the overwhelmingly peaceful racial justice protests from more ethnically motivated or nationalist groups in the United States. And so we saw all these groups kind of coalesce into something that was anti-government. And on January 6th, that was coordinated online 3 months before, and there was a very large body. We published a very large body of evidence, and so we saw it coming. What we've seen since then, and this is an important part, is that you see the photos of the insurrection or attempt on January 6th, and it looks like one big crowd. But going back to my first point, there were a bunch of groups that were smaller that were there for different reasons. Right? One was to coordinate an attack. Another was there to just kind of witness things, right? Witness history because they believed in misinformation or they engaged in misinformation. And so the interventions for those groups are going to be very different. And that's what you see playing out in the United States right now, the rule of law. There's a lot of criminal investigations into the folks that did really, really unlawful things that day and then posted selfies about it or recorded it online. And what we've seen in the year since is, for sure, more activity, right? But because that was such a high-profile event, we've seen a shift in focus from the most kind of extreme of those groups to engage in more local activity as opposed to national activity. And so it's not as big, right? They're not coordinating in one place online like we saw on January 6th. They've kind of dispersed. But it's certainly a trend that is engaging less with mainstream audiences in the United States at this point. But for those who are already engaged, they're certainly becoming more and more extreme in their views because they are shut out, because they have less power. And that remains a very, very large problem. We have a growing potential political violence problem, not just in the United States, but in Western democracies. And it's because it's because of any number of things, but this is something that we have to address if we want to remain, again, going back to an overarching theme of this conversation, transparent and accountable, and have trust in the governments that in democracies, we still get to choose and hold accountable.
But to kind of encapsulate this or to take stock of the situation more than a year later, would you say that American society, but also institutions, systems, have they become more resilient, or could we hypothetically have another such scenario, maybe not playing out exactly like this, but another mode of this in the coming months or years?
Listen, the undercurrents of what led to January 6th still exist, and that still remains an enormous challenge. And it is a significantly large population within the United States that believes that. And there's been a concerted effort in the year after January 6th to kind of revise history to say, oh, well, no, this is appropriate political activity.
Legitimate protest.
Right. This kind of... And it wasn't, to be clear. I mean, there were folks there that were there to just witness something. There were folks there to attack the heart of our democracy, the seat of our democracy. And so we've got to address that. And I think that we are addressing that. I'm hopeful. I mean, there was an attempt to overturn the results of a free, fair, and extraordinarily complicated election happening in the middle of a pandemic. By most metrics, it was the most secure election in history.
Yeah.
And that's undeniable. They've done audits and audits and audits. There have been legal challenges to the results of the election. None of those have worked because it was secure. And so I'm hopeful because our institutions worked and continue to work. And it's a reminder of how it's not inevitable in any democracy around the world. You have to work at it. You have a responsibility to make sure that those institutions work. And frankly, it's not up to anybody else. Everybody kind of looks at something, a challenge like this, and says, oh, well, you know, I voted. My responsibility is taken care of. I don't have to do anything else. And the fact is, it's all of our responsibility to hold each other accountable in a democracy. That's how this works. It's our responsibility to one another.
I think on this optimistic note, we can conclude. Thank you so much for your time. It was a truly valuable and far-reaching conversation. And thank you for coming to Riga as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you for joining us.